Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The British statesman and philosopher Edmund Burke was the first who came up with the idea of urban parks as the lungs of a city. Well, back in the 18th century, parks were the only place to escape the closed back alleys and the choke of coal dust and smoke. Witold Rybinski, the author and architect, takes that one step further when he talks about New York's Central Park. He calls it the heart of that city. Some would go even further and talk about their own park space as the soul of their city. Wherever the parks are, they evoke some of the most powerful emotions that city dwellers can muster. This hour, we'll look at a city blessed with parkland and one without. The landscape architect, Frederick Law Olmsted, left a legacy of parkland in American cities from Boston to New York, Buffalo, Louisville, Seattle, Portland. His firm also drew up a park plan for Los Angeles. But 70 years ago, the California city fathers nixed that plan. So we'll hear from one of Olmsted's disciples in New York and from a man who is still fighting for that parkland in L.A. But Connection listeners, we also need to hear from you. What does your park mean in your life? What's its place in your town or your city? Is it just about health or fresh air or exercise, or is it something even more than that? And here's something for you scholars. Is it true that we are only just now starting to see what a visionary Olmsted really was? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, while Central Park is perhaps Mr. Olmsted's masterpiece, he left New York with many other parks, and one of the best known is Prospect Park in Brooklyn. For 23 years, Tupper Thomas has been administrator of that park, and she's joining us from our NPR bureau in New York City. Hi, Tupper.
Hi, how you doing, Dick?
I'm great. It's great to have you on the program. I just want to introduce our other guest because while a great number of people have been pushing for parkland in Los Angeles, the man whose name's most associated with trying to revive that dream is probably Robert Garcia. He's director of the City Project for the Center for Law and the Public Interest, and he's joining us from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Robert, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, Dick. Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you both here. Tupper, I'm going to start with you because, you know, if you're going to devote 23 years trying to get a bunch of New Yorkers to agree on anything, you must have quite a passion about what it is you want them to agree on. Tell me a little bit about this Prospect Park of yours.
Oh, just a little bit?
We only have an hour on the program, you know?
I know it. Actually, Prospect Park is a fabulous park, and I always say that Central Park is where Olmsted and Vaux really learned how to do parks. Both had been influenced by the English system of beautiful estates for wealthy people, and they wanted them to be wonderful parks to be available to the common man. And so they created Central Park with enormous political angst and problems. And then they came to Brooklyn, where the city fathers of Brooklyn, which was then a separate city, said, we will give you carte blanche to do the most perfect park you could ever do. And so they proceeded to spend money, but manage the facility and do it all as a fabulous park. And so we've been able to have a wonderful, designed, beautiful park in the heart of Brooklyn, which is 2.5 million people. And even though we finally had to become part of New York City, we are...
You're still not over that, are you?
Well, people in Brooklyn just cannot forget it.
I want you to, Tupper, just walk me through, though, one of those stone arches that leads to the meadows of Prospect Park, because Olmsted had something very specific in mind when he did that, and I'm wondering whether or not he succeeded in your view.
He totally succeeded. If you start at Grand Army Plaza, which is the intersection of Flatbush Avenue and Eastern Parkway, busy, crazy traffic circle, roaring cars going around and horns honking and lots of excitement going on. And you walk about, 20 feet. All of a sudden, it is peaceful. All of a sudden, you start to hear birds, and you walk slowly along this walk until you see a little bit of architecture in front of you, and you're thinking, ooh, that might be the way I'd like to turn. Mm-hmm. And you turn that corner, and all of a sudden, this beautifully framed picture of a meadow that stretches out as far as you can see, with trees and grass and everything right before you. And that's when he talked about that sense of enlarged freedom, that way that you would go to a park and feel like you were free, like you were in a democracy, that you were part of a fabulous world. And it was really designed for people who had no money, had no other means of finding recreation and peace in their souls, and that they could go to this park that was designed like an English estate and feel that wonderful sense of nature and its beauty.
And Robert Garcia, I just wonder what it's like for you in Los Angeles to listen to Tupper describe that sense of enlarged freedom in New York City, know that you could have had it in Los Angeles, that you were so close.
We could have had it, but we are also working to get it. In 1930, the landscape architecture firm that Frederick Law Olmsted started with his sons proposed a plan for Los Angeles. It called for a comprehensive and coherent web of parks, playgrounds, schools, beaches, and transportation that, if it had been implemented, would have made Los Angeles one of the most beautiful and livable cities in the world. And tragically, in 1930, 200 copies of the report were published. The Los Angeles Times and other civic leaders killed the report, really for three major reasons. First of all, at the time, nobody had the vision or the foresight to realize Los Angeles would come to choke itself with congestion and population and cars. Second, it called for a regional park authority, and different government agencies simply weren't willing to work together to create parks. And third, the price tag that the Olmsteds estimated was about $230 million, which at the time seemed like a lot of money. Today, it would just buy about 230 acres in a region that's about 1,500 square miles. So the report was killed. It didn't go anywhere. But in the last 3 years, almost 7 years later, the urban park movement in Los Angeles has been achieving dramatic victories to restore part of the lost vision of the Olmsted Report and a part of the lost beauty of Los Angeles.
Is there space there, Robert? I would have thought that in the past 70 years that the land perhaps set aside by the Olmsted firm would have been all covered up with houses and freeways.
Much of it is. They proposed a total of about 70,000 acres in the heart of Los Angeles.
70,000 acres.
70,000
wow.
acres.
Central Park's 800 acres. Am I right about that, Tupper?
Yeah, it's 840.
Wow. Okay, so we're talking about a lot of parkland. Robert, go on.
And certainly there's not as much open space left anymore. And today, an acre of land in the heart of L.A. goes from anywhere from $1 million to $5 million. But there is still space. For example, about 2 or 3 years ago, an abandoned rail yard right in the heart of L.A., called the Chinatown Cornfield, a 40-acre site, the last vast open space in downtown L.A., the city of L.A. and Majestic Realty were proposing building 40 acres of warehouses on that site.
Lovely.
But the Chinatown Yard Alliance stopped that proposal. The city was proposing using federal subsidies to make that deal profitable for Majestic. We persuaded Andrew Cuomo, the secretary of HUD at the time, to withhold any federal subsidies for that project unless there was a full environmental impact report that considered the park alternative and considered the impact of those warehouses on inner city communities. Cuomo withheld the funding. Majestic and the Chinatown Yard Alliance came to an agreement, and together we persuaded the state of California, Governor Gray Davis, to buy that site for a park. It will be the first urban state park in the heart of L.A. Similarly, just about 2 miles up the L.A. River.
Just before we go on to the other places, because I know that you've a number that you're working on, and in fact, a great deal to be proud of in terms of what you're able to achieve these days, particularly with government money so slight. But Robert, you also lived in New York, so you know Prospect Park, you know Central Park very well, right?
Yes.
Between the two of you, tell me what it was that Olmsted was able to see that other people weren't able to see. Back in the mid-1800s.
Well, I think that what Robert just said about having the vision of what it would look like later, And that the LA people didn't have that. And I think that's what Olmsted had that was so fabulous, is he understood that there was going to be a great revolution, industrial revolution, and that there would be things that would happen to the city that would have to involve having parks saved now. And so he was always on a soapbox. Listening to Robert talk reminds me of all the things you've read of Olmsted's, where he just kept fighting and fighting in every city that he worked in to save and set aside parkland, because it would become the heart and soul of the city. And the way that community develops is essential to having that open space, so that people have a place that they call their own and their backyard or their park.
I agree. It's also important to remember, in this society we forget, that Frederick Law Olmsted's twin passions were, first of all, creating parks, and second, the abolition of slavery. And his commitment to democratic ideals, to equal justice, were reflected in the design for parks. In Central Park, for example, something as concrete as there were three ways of going through the park. One, carriage trails for families that could afford horse-drawn carriages. Second, just horse trails for mostly single men riding through the park on their horses. But third, walking trails, because Olmsted designed that park as a democratic commons where people from all classes in Manhattan would be able to get together as equals. And so something as seemingly simple as that, walking trails, bridle trails, and carriage trails, were all an integral part of that design.
I mean, his his idea of democracy, of the park as a democratizing force, was something that he very specifically built into the structure of the park. So it wasn't just a happy accident.
Absolutely.
One of the other things that happened in a number of the parks, both Central Prospect and a number of them in Boston, were dairies. He would actually have cows in the park that would be grazing there, and then the milk was used to give to the poor women who could not get fresh milk for their children. And he created these lovely spaces in the woodlands that were shady and quiet and so on, that women could come to with their children for fresh milk and for the coolness that they needed. Remember, there was no air conditioning. And so it was very important that community sense was just so much part of it, that this building of the community of Brooklyn or of New York City or of L.A. or any of these things were so essential. And that's what parks still serve, that purpose.
All right, Connection listeners, you've had a chance to listen to a couple of people who make it their lives, their business, to look out for the interests of parkland in a city, and not just so they can get a lung full of fresh air, but for many and more specific reasons than that. What about the park where you live, and what about the importance of the city park in your town? We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we're talking about city parks at an appropriate time of the year when people get to wander under those broad leaves and get a little bit of the shade and the cool air that you can find in places that you'll never find between tall city buildings. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, Tupper Turner. She's not only administrator of Prospect Park in Brooklyn, New York, Brooklyn, New York State, I can say it that way. But president of the Prospect Park Alliance and co-chairman of the board of City Park Alliance. That's a new national group lobbying on behalf of more and better urban parks. Robert Garcia is joining us as well. He's director of the City Project for the Center for Law and the Public Interest based in Santa Monica, California. We've been talking with Robert about a big push that's underway now to try and get more city park land set aside, a la Frederick Law Olmsted in Los Angeles. And I guess, Robert, I'd be interested in your perspective. If L.A. had set aside even some of that parkland back in the 1930s, do you think that the character of Los Angeles would be different today?
Without a doubt. The proposal that the Olmsteds had, the vision that they had, included 70,000 acres of parks, but also a parkway system, 214 miles of parkways. And if you can imagine the L.A. freeway system with a quarter-mile strip of green down the center divider and a quarter-mile strip of green on either side, that will begin to tell you the kind of vision they had for the Los Angeles region. Instead, what we have today are freeways with concrete center dividers, right, and concrete sound walls on either side. The 51-mile Los Angeles River has been drowned in concrete by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Wait, the Los Angeles River?
Absolutely. Most people don't know that exists. It starts out in the San Fernando Valley, and it flows through downtown Los Angeles all the way to Long Beach, 51 miles. And that's part of the vision that we're working with Friends of the Los Angeles River and others on today, is the greening of the river.
I mean, if we look back in just in recent years at the violence in places like South Central L.A., I know that, you know, we'd be a little bit over the top to say if there were more parks nearby, that wouldn't have happened. But that kind of frustration and anger and discomfort in a hot and angry city, do you think parks would have made any difference?
Yes, indeed. In 1992, after the riots and rebellion following the acquittals in the Rodney King case, the Crips and the Bloods reached a truce. And they presented a set of demands to the people of Los Angeles. And one of their top demands, one of their top 10 demands, was the creation of more parks and maintaining parks in better condition. Hmm. Because they recognize, as well as anybody, that parks provide an alternative to gangs, crime, violence, drugs, prostitution. It's also interesting, no parks were destroyed during the riots and rebellion.
And Tupper Turner, a good friend of mine, spent some 5 years in the 90s living right beside Prospect Park. And at that time, you were in the middle of you know, trying to create a greater reconciliation between the upper income people on one side and the lower income people on the other side. But she said that it did, in fact, the park had that effect of creating a space where people from different classes and races and colors in New York would mix and quite comfortably.
It's absolutely true. In fact, just this morning, I was taking somebody around the park trying to raise a little money. And there we were. And he said, look, there are Hasidic women. There are Caribbean women. There are Latinos. There are there's everybody all on the roadway at the same time. We've already closed the roads at 9 in the morning. Traffic is out of the park by 9 a.m. And it was fabulous to see how many people were out. And we've done a lot of things to encourage community use of the park. So there was a small group of drummers, African drummers, who were coming to the park, and we actually helped them to create a drummer's grove so that every Sunday from 2 o'clock till 8 o'clock, they drum in the park and vendors come and the public comes by. And it has become a wonderful place of culture. That's what the parks were intended to be, a place where your culture could be seen by many other people. Not just a recreational place, not just a beautiful place, right, but a place of culture.
Let's go to Attleboro, Massachusetts. Frank's on the line, and we'll start there. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I want to ask a provocative question, not one that I agree with, but just to stir it up. What if I pretended I was Bushy and I said to your guests, well, who cares about these democratizing aspects of parks? Why not just let the marketplace provide recreation? Those who can afford it, of course, will will purchase what they want, and for the rest of them, they can meet each other in the streets.
Robert Garcia.
First of all, I think parks, even under traditional economic theories, free market theories, parks are recognized as one of the paradigm examples of a public good in which the market simply will not provide enough of a market good because there's nobody to write the check for the benefits that parks create for everyone, not just for the people who pay to use it, but for everybody else. So it's a market imperfection that there are not enough parks. And that's one legitimate role for government, is to step in and buy the land and maintain the parks. Second, we suffer from much of those imperfections in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is park poor, has fewer acres of parks per 1,000 residents compared to any major city in the country. And there are also unfair disparities in access to parks. In the inner city, where communities of color live disproportionately, there are 0.3 acres of parks per 1,000 residents compared to 1.7 acres in disproportionately white, relatively wealthy parts of L.A. The national standard for parks is 6 to 10 acres per 1,000 residents. So in Los Angeles, where people on the west side can afford to have their own backyards, their own country clubs, can afford to leave the city and go to national parks or other countries for recreation, we have what you're talking about, a society in which recreation, the health benefits of parks are allocated primarily on the basis of who can afford to pay.
But aren't we also in a situation where the most park improvements are being paid for with private dollars anyway? I mean, certainly the money that's gone into the rehabilitation of Central Park, a lot of that has been private. And Tupper, you've been talking about the work that you do, drumming up private money. Does that mean that governments just aren't going to put the money into parkland or aren't willing to do that?
We hope not. We hope that that's not what that means. We hope that Central Park sets the bar for what a park should look like. And one of the things that came up over and over again in our conference was this whole idea of a green line for cities, that every city should have a green level below which it will not drop, and where they can expect that parks will be in good, good condition. And that's one of the things that our new organization, the City Parks Alliance, is hoping to really pursue nationally.
Has Central Park already raised the bar a little bit? Has Central Park shown other cities right across the country what can be done?
As always, Central Park has led the way in so many, many things. They led the way in first being a beautiful park, but then in their restoration work, they have shown what you should be able to expect from every park across the country, that it should be as well maintained and as beautiful as possible. And there's no reason why poor people and rich people shouldn't have the exact same thing. And I think that the public is willing to pay for that. Whenever polls are done that ask people what their top priority are, no matter what their economic level is, it comes out parks as being a top priority, and it doesn't cost much. And I believe that Mayor Bloomberg, for instance, here in New York, has actually figured that out. One of the first things he restored after his, quote, doomsday budget was the cuts to New York City parks, because he, I think, understands how totally important the parks are to everyday quality of life of New Yorkers, that people don't want to be paying taxes if they aren't getting something they can use all the time.
And Robert Garcia, you've got evidence of that in Los Angeles with Proposition 40, isn't it, where you had people at every economic level of L.A. backing this. What were they backing?
Yes, that was actually not just Los Angeles. That was statewide. Proposition 40 in March of 2002 passed statewide. It provided $2.6 billion for parks, clean air, and clean water. It is the largest natural resource bond in U.S. history. But just as importantly, Prop 40 demolished the myth that the environment is a luxury that communities of color and low-income communities cannot afford or are not willing to pay for. People voted to tax themselves to create the kind of community where they want to live and raise children. 77% of African-American voters, 74% of Latino voters, 60% of Asian voters and 56% of non-Hispanic whites voted in support of Prop 40.
Well, they were talking about this from church pulpits. They were going door to door. This was a really big grassroots campaign.
Absolutely. Direct mail pieces in Spanish and English to targeted Latino voters. Los Angeles Metropolitan Churches organized African-American ministers from the pulpit, as you said, to advocate for Prop 40. Cardinal Roger Mahoney endorsed Prop 40. Again, it's a recognition in the wake in California of 1978's Proposition 13, which cut off local funding for schools and parks. People 30 years later are realizing we have to tax ourselves. We have to pay more to create the kind of city where we want to live.
Let's go back to our telephone lines if we can. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Your park story today on The Connection. Let's go to Hilton Head, South Carolina. Michael's joining us. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I guess what I'd like to comment on or get a reaction from is to get a little bit more history on Mr. Olmsted. I guess my understanding of what he did is he somewhat transitioned an era and brought the idea of parks into being as part of the urban landscape, where prior to him, and he was, my understanding is even he had a part in that, was people did not used to it go to parks. Cemeteries were actually used as a recreational area.
Tupper Turner, can you help us on this?
Yes, that absolutely was true. In Boston, the major park was a cemetery. In Brooklyn, the major park was a cemetery. That's when people started realizing how important it was, and the city, the elected officials said, "Ooh, this might be a good deal. We can see that this is what people want." And so there were actually some far thinkers well before Olmsted and Vaux came on the scene. They simply won the bid for Central Park. But Central Park was really understood by the elected officials of Manhattan that was a very important thing to do. And then in Brooklyn again, and in Boston, and in Buffalo, and all over and then in Chicago, working its way across the country, the elected officials were the ones who said, "This is a smart idea. This is improving our property values." You know, they didn't say, "Ooh, this is teaching democracy to the people," because they didn't have the vision that Olmsted had, but they sure saw that it was an important part to the best development of the cities that were happening at that time.
All right, Michael, thanks very much for that call. 1-800-423-8255 to Louisville, Kentucky now, and Robert's joining us. Hi, Robert.
Good morning, all, and thank you so much for what a great conversation.
Well, Louisville stands among other cities as a grateful recipient of the wisdom of Mr. Olmsted, doesn't it?
You know, I was surprised while I was multitasking, waiting to come on, to learn as much as I've just learned about our park system. I wanted to speak up about Cherokee Park, which is a beautiful, beautiful park here in Louisville. And what I found out was that our park system is one of only five Olmsted park systems in existence. 18 parks and 6 parkways over a 50-year period. 2,000 parkland acres and 15 parkway miles. It was just amazing for me to learn. I thought there was a cemetery in Louisville and a park that Olmsted had something to do with. And my, how I was surprised to find out that that's wrong. I just want to say that for people who are naysayers about the most important, the great importance of parks to communities, it's balderdash. I mean, it's just craziness. In 1974...
Robert, let me ask you something, if I can. I mean, we're talking about how parks actually create the character of a city. And I'm wondering if you can take a look at Louisville and compare it to neighboring cities, because I know there's lots there, and say that, yeah, it's this or it's not.
Well, as a matter of fact... I've lived in Atlanta, and I've lived in Connecticut, in Norwalk, Connecticut, and so I've seen a little bit of the difference. And one of the things that's most important is how people are involved in their parks. I learned today about our park system by going to olmstedparks.org, and it's about our park system. But there are so many opportunities for volunteerism, and obviously there's ways to make contributions. And I think it's not just, rebuilding a park, or it's more than just, putting money at it, but it's using that park, making sure it's there.
And let me just stop you there, Robert. I thank you for your call, because I want to go to Robert Garcia. When you've got a city that's lacking that kind of park space, how do you inspire people to become volunteers, to actually get behind a push to create something that's not even there? Because at least Tupper has the luxury of saying, see what we've got, see what it could be.
One of the things that has been most successful in Los Angeles in the urban park movement is coalition building, the broadest, most diverse alliance ever to come together behind any issue in Los Angeles has come together behind the creation of parks. And one of the reasons for that is there are so many different values at stake that different stakeholders come to the table for different reasons. For example, at the most basic level, the simplest level, parks simply provide the simple joys of playing in the park to the children of L.A. But at another level, health, human health is so important. 40% of California's children are not physically fit. 25% of California's children are overweight or obese. This doesn't mean simply that children are fat and lazy. Children face a greater risk now of diseases like diabetes, which will lead long-term to blindness and amputations of limbs. As I mentioned earlier, parks and recreation providing alternatives to gangs, crimes, and violence. In Latino communities, Latino immigrant communities, soccer has been one of the central organizing tools. New Latino immigrants in the United States don't organize politically. They organize soccer leagues, mm-hmm. and from there they learn, much like the political machines in New York City at the turn of the century, they learn how to organize, how to go to government and get what they want. And what they're asking for in Los Angeles now is parks. So the different values at stake, the beauty of the earth, the glory of the sky, the serenity of the Los Angeles River, the joy of the people, and the future of our children, these are bringing people together to create parks in L.A. Throughout the state.
Hard to argue with any of that. Connection listeners, how do you see parks as either shaping or having shaped the character of the place where you live? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about city parks this hour. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. A quick apology and correction. I've mentioned a couple of times the name Tupper Turner. In fact, my guest in New York is Tupper Thomas. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
Tupper, my own scribbles getting me in trouble here. Tupper is administrator of Prospect Park in Brooklyn, New York, and co-chair of the board of City Park Alliance. It's a new national group lobbying on behalf of more and better urban parks. And Robert Garcia would give his eye teeth for more and better urban parks in Los Angeles, where he's been making it his business to fight for new green space in that city. He's director of the City Project for the Center of Law and the Public Interest, based in Santa Monica, California. Let's go back to our phone lines to Buffalo, New York, another recipient of an Olmsted development. And Jonathan's joining us. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Dick.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. So I have a pretty straightforward question for your guests, which is how, as park commissioners and park activists, you reconcile Olmsted's vision of the park as a place for contemplation of and enjoyment of the natural picturesque with ideas that the progressive era brought in of the park as a place for athletic recreation and, basketball courts and soccer fields and golf courses and so forth.
They used to fight about whether or not you could play baseball in Central Park or swing a golf club there.
Exactly.
What's your opinion about it, Jonathan?
Well, I obviously think both should be incorporated in the vision. Here in Buffalo, there is a certain degree of tension, not regarding perhaps the traditional, the original Olmsted parks, but
right.
what the Olmsted Conservancy does in incorporating new park space into the system. You know, often the idea of a park is, well, let's just put a grass court in and some goal posts and an ash can in a parking lot, you know. And that's not exactly what Olmsted had in mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, how can that be communicated, what with all of the cultural and class differences?
Tupper Thomas, you know? Can I play croquet or cricket in Prospect Park?
Well, you could do a pickup game of cricket. We don't have cricket fields, but it's an ongoing issue that I think is totally solvable with, as long as management and citizenry both educate themselves about what's necessary. There are going to be some things that you just aren't going to ever be able to do in Prospect Park, like dirt biking, because we have fabulous forests. Yes. But there are other things. Even swinging a golf ball could be a golf club could be terribly dangerous because of the numbers of people that are there, and it's not a golf course. But we have tried to work out ways to have pickup soccer, pickup baseball, things that can happen around and about. And then we have baseball diamonds and soccer fields that are in an area right next to the park called the parade ground where that can pick up and happen. And I think that all cities have to offer all things, but none of it has to be ugly. The fact is that you can create, for instance, our fabulous parade ground that has 10 various kinds of fields, soccer, football, baseball,
Do you sign up
basketball.
For those fields or can you just
yes,
show
you,
up? You have to sign
no,
up, right?
You get a permit to use them, and they're used by people from all over, including lots of those Latino soccer groups that Robert was talking about. And you can sign up for them. They're sometimes used by other people as pickup games later. But they don't have to be ugly. They can still have trees. They can still look nice and provide that kind of beauty. And Olmsted was totally in favor of recreation and built into, particularly in the Buffalo system, a number of recreational areas because recreation was just coming of age in the Olmsted era. But the later parks that were done by his firm, his sons, had lots and lots of actually active recreation in them. But it doesn't mean ugly. It just means different ways of using open space that can still have trees and flowers and so on.
There you go, Jonathan. You can go to Buffalo City Council and say that it was Olmsted who intended that we have the right to go ice skating here or whatever it is that you want to do.
Right. Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, just to be a bit of devil's advocate, I'm just wondering how you communicate Olmsted's particular. He had a very particular kind of English vision of the park, you know, and if that's still part of the picture these days.
I think Jonathan's point is very good, reconciling the natural or naturalistic view of a park versus the recreation view. But in Central Park today, they have beach volleyball in Central Park. They've actually created a sand box, for lack of a better term, and they put a volleyball court in there. So Central Park has evolved, and that's a testament to the vision and to the amount of space they have there so that they can have something for everybody. In Los Angeles today, sadly, that has become an issue on the cornfield, on Taylor Yard, which are state parks. State Parks has articulated the view that their business is to create wilderness parks, not to provide for active recreation, and that's a bump in the road. But that's what shock absorbers are for. We're working with the city and with the state to find creative ways of putting in playing fields, ball fields in the cornfield, in Taylor Yard, and integrate them so that there will be balanced parks with spaces for hiking, riparian parks, natural settings alongside the playing fields. There has to be room for both.
Before I look
and
it
I
up,
think
riparian
Olmsted
parks?
Would
what's,
agree.
What's riparian parks?
In Taylor Yard, there's 2 miles stretch along the river. It will be where the park meets the water.
Gotcha. All right. 1-800-423-8255. Jonathan, thanks for that. Let's go back to Louisville, Kentucky now. Francine's joining us. Hi, Francine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's up?
Back in 1997 or 98, I was an AmeriCorps member, probably one of the oldest AmeriCorps members. But we were having an annual meeting here in Louisville, and my job was to plan service projects for everybody. And one of the largest service projects that I planned for the group was cleaning one of our Olmsted parks, which is Shawnee Park, and it's located in the west end of the city of Louisville. And
the city wasn't cleaning it, Francine?
Well, I can't say yes or no because I don't know. It had not been cleaned in a while.
Right.
I mean, deep cleaning where people dump things.
The really icky stuff.
Yeah, and so we did that. It was an icky job, but it was one of the best jobs we ever, you know, planned. We worked with the Olmsted Conservancy here to complete that job.
Tell me something, Francine. Once the park was clean, did the people living around it or the people involved in the cleanup make sure that it stayed that way? Was there a did the pride in the park go up along with its level of cleanliness?
There has always been a pride in that particular park. We have so many that, you know, it receives not as much attention as some, but it's a family thing. I mean, you have your family picnics, your family get together. People plan their family reunions. Politicians go and do their thing. And after we did clean it up, it's been a while. I know that the plan was to replant some of the early flowers and put it back into the condition that it was in. And yes, that has happened. And it's still ongoing. It's a never-ending story. There's another park, Iroquois Park, here.
Let me stop you if I can, because I'm interested in bringing Tupper Thomas in here on the work that you've done, because you've got more than two decades of experience to watch the way that people react to improvements at Prospect Park in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and whether or not the level of pride or the level of cleanliness, you know, keeps going up or does it fluctuate?
It absolutely continues to go up. That once some place is clean, when people arrive there, they might leave their garbage, but they're going to start leaving it near the garbage can. They fill the cans. They put the garbage there. On the whole, if you go to the park like yesterday morning, after we've had no nice weather in New York for like years, it seems like. And so this weekend was packed. Every single city park was packed. Now, in Prospect Park, at least, there was a lot of garbage. Lots of picnics had happened, but the garbage was contained. It was near cans. It wasn't spread all over the place as it had been many years ago. We have over 6,000 people who volunteered sometime last year in Prospect Park. And when the citizens come into a clean park, they feel better about it and they leave it cleaner. It's just like graffiti. If it's gone right away, it doesn't come back. And I think that Louisville is a fabulous example of a wonderful city, a small city that has really taken their parks back. And the parks that you've been talking about here are very much that concept, that the citizenry of Louisville really took it on and said, we're not going to let our parks fall behind. And this is happening all over the country. And that's why, even with terrible cuts in city budgets, we're seeing this enormous volunteer effort going on to try to keep parks looking fabulous and to join a national movement.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Amherst, Massachusetts. Carrie's joining us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. This is a quick Central Park story. But first, two quick comments. And one is, there's a reason people pay thousands of dollars to live in a closet in New York. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of life going on in that city. And also in L.A., get the athletes, the professional athletes involved, the Lakers and Angels, to promote this park idea. But my Central Park story is, 2 years ago, my daughter was living on 110th Street, which is on the north side of the park, the north beginning of the park. And we got up on a Sunday morning to go to a cafe clear across the park. And it was a gorgeous Sunday morning. It was 8 o'clock. You're not going to believe this. There was not a piece of paper, not one cigarette butt on the ground. And this was Sunday morning. And when we came back through the park, of course, people were out there reading the paper, having their you know, breakfast, and it was just green grass glistening in the sun. It was, you could see why people will pay any amount of money sometimes to be around this sort of environment. So, you can't have too much.
So that's their front yard. That's their backyard. That's, and they treat it like that. That was your view when you were walking through it on that Sunday morning.
You got it.
All right, Carrie, thanks a lot for your call. I want to go to Robert Garcia and ask you to close your eyes and imagine a little bit for us, Robert, whether or not there'll be a time when, whether or not it's Baldwin Hills or Taylor Yard or Chinatown's cornfield, that L.A. will have that kind of space to boast about.
Yes, it's on the verge of that now. And we are now advocating for one big park in the heart of Los Angeles, what we call the Heritage Parkway, which will link Taylor Yard, the cornfield, El Pueblo State Historic Park, the birthplace of L.A., with 100 cultural, historical, environmental, and recreational links. And just as New York now, when people think of New York, they think of Central Park.
Yeah.
We think within five to 10 years, when people think of L.A., they will think of the Heritage Parkway and the parks at the heart of Los Angeles and the 50-year plan to implement a coherent web of parks, playgrounds, schools, and beaches.
Tupper, quick last question for you. This City Park Alliance that you're heading up now, the national group, can that make a difference for what Robert's working on? Because it seems to me that most of the muscle that goes to improving a park in a town or in a city comes from locals.
It absolutely does come from locals and has to come from locals. But one of the things that we're finding is that nobody knows what the other one is doing. There are best practices. There is networking that happens in almost every other field, any science field, any health field, any even sports fields. There's a network that is established that lets you know what other people are doing and are up against. And so Robert's story is a perfect story to say, look, this is what's happening in L.A., and maybe they can learn from what's happening in Minnesota or in Nebraska or in Texas, and we can all learn from each other. The other thing is that funding from the government is essential, and it isn't just city funding or just state funding, but the federal government puts Zippo. This year there was a zero allocation for the UPAR program, which has been the only program they ever had.
Tupper,
so
I
we
need to
think that
I need to stop
federal
there.
Money is essential.
I got you. Thanks for being with us on the program. That's Tupper Thomas. She's the administrator of Prospect Park in Brooklyn and president of the Prospect Park Alliance. Robert Garcia, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Robert Garcia is director of the City Project at the Center for Law in the Public Interest. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Can you dig it? Yes, I can. And I've been waiting such a long time.